Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Yesterday, the Pentagon said the U.S. military dropped a 22,000-pound bomb on a complex of tunnels in Afghanistan's Achin province near the Pakistan border. It was the first time the military used what it calls its most deadly non-nuclear bomb. Afghan officials say the bomb killed 36 ISIS fighters. Joining us to talk about media coverage, which is mostly based on Pentagon statements, is Ali Latifi, a journalist who's based in Afghanistan. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show. Or Ali will be joining us in just a couple minutes. And then later in the show, we will discuss Exxon CEO turned Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's recent visit to Russia and U.S.-Russia climate change policies, which are very similar. Both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin deny climate change. Inside Climate News has spent almost 2 years looking at Rex Tillerson and Exxon's records on climate change. Neela Banerjee is an award-winning reporter for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization that covers clean energy, carbon energy, nuclear energy, and environmental science. Neela covered global energy, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and other issues for the New York Times. She was also the Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Neela. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And SF Public Press is out with a new investigation looking at climate change, sea level rise, and waterfront developments in San Francisco. The paper is now in stores. It'll be online on Monday. This investigation found that hundreds of acres in San Francisco could flood by the year 2100 if sea rise and storm surges reach 8 feet. Active building permits there exceed $2.3 billion in construction costs. Michael Stoll is executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit news organization that publishes a quarterly newspaper, and they do excellent journalism. And Michael Stoll is with us in studio. Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Michael Stoll, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
The surprising and encouraging story of the East Bay Times, the collection of newspapers ringing the bay outside of San Francisco, including the Mercury News and the Oakland Tribune and the Contra Costa Times that have been merged into the East Bay Times, won a Pulitzer Prize this week for their in-depth, relentless investigation of the ghost ship fire late last year. And I think what the Pulitzer Board said distinguished what they did was that they were able to break a couple of stories about code violations within 12 hours of the fire happening. They dove in and they investigated the causes, talked to most of the victims' families and many of the people who survived the fire, and really started to make change in Oakland immediately. And it was just really encouraging to see a newsroom that has been, you know, in the past decade really kind of buffeted by cutbacks and downsizing of their journalism infrastructure, really rally to the cause and come together as a team and make change. Mm.
Yes, so huge congratulations and great work for our colleagues at the East Bay Times. That is Michael Stoll, executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press. And what about you, Neela Banerjee? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I will continue in the same vein as Michael to draw attention to some journalism that's been done in the past year. That was a finalist for the Pulitzer in the explanatory journalism category. And it's a metro paper, the Chattanooga Times Free Press. And they were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in explanatory journalism for a terrific series that they did called The Poverty Puzzle. And, you know, the bar there is that you're writing about poverty and people being left behind by an economic boom, and that's a story that a lot of people write, and a lot of people, you know, you would think that it's old news and why would you read it, but they did such a stellar job with it. And you know, if you not look at not just those who won the Pulitzer Prize but the finalists as well in the categories, you know, what you'll see is that despite the cutbacks and despite the shrinkage of the profession, American journalism is robust and healthy and shedding light on important issues in our communities and around the world. And you know, in an overarching way, if you look at what the Pulitzer Prizes pointed to, is that investigative journalism is the order of the day, whether it's in your communities or on the national level. So if you're going to read anything that's not actually one of the winners, I totally recommend the series from Chattanooga.
Well, thank you for that. And just as you said, there was so much amazing journalism coming out, and sometimes you just have to really search for it. And we will put links to all of the winners at yourcallradio.org. That is Neela Banerjee, an award-winning reporter for Inside Climate News. They're also a Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization covering climate change. And Ali Latifi, thank you again for joining us. Ali, you're in Jalalabad. And I want to start off with you. You have obviously been so focused on what happened yesterday in Afghanistan's Aachen province near the Pakistan border. You have also been tweeting in response to the reporting. Before we dive in and talk about that, not much has been reported about this area. How big is this area? How many people live in this area? Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So the area is actually, because the area that we're talking about covers actually several districts within Ningarhar, the area that Daesh has a present in the province. So it's not just Aachen, although Aachen is considered one of their long-term bases. It's established over the last 3 years. So this would affect tens of thousands of families in terms of a Daesh presence. These are all, you know, in the east of Ningarhar, you know, different districts that have been taken over by different levels of Daesh forces over the last 3 years. So this has been an ongoing problem. But of course, the matter of Daesh in Afghanistan has always been something that's never been clearly explained. Because even if you talk to the average person in Ningarhar, even the ones that escaped from the districts where Daesh are in, they'll all say, we don't know exactly what they want or why they're here or specifically who they are. And there's a real fear of them. You know, whenever I've spoken to people who have fled from Daesh areas, they usually say, as soon as we figure out who they are, as soon as they say they're Daesh, it doesn't take very long for us to want to escape, to want to flee. So there is definitely the sense that Daesh is trying to gain ground in these districts. But then there's also the issue of the numbers. The numbers have been under question for the last 3 years.
Tell us more about that.
So basically, you know, most estimates would say at this point that maybe there are about 1,000.
A
couple hundred. And that might actually be being generous at this point. And it's interesting because in the beginning of the year, the Ministry of Defense put out one figure. If I remember correctly, they said that they killed 1,500 Daesh fighters. And then just before that, in the summer, General Nicholson, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, said that there's maybe 1,100, 1,200 Daesh left in the country total. Now, I may be off on the figures just a little bit, but the point is that, you know, there isn't necessarily an agreement on the number of Daesh fighters in the country. So I think this is also what's sort of really interesting about this case of using the quote-unquote mother of all bombs on Daesh forces in Afghanistan, because the question is, you know, who are you fighting? What do they really want? How many of them are there? Why did you target them out of all, you know, I mean, the Afghan government and the U.S. government has been saying repeatedly in the last few months that there are something like 20 different armed international groups in the country. Now, of course, some of those groups may only have a few dozen fighters, but still, you know, the fact that they took this weapon, you know, that's considered the highest grade military non-atomic weapon and used it in Aachen district, you know, on supposed Daesh fighters, on a group of about 100, you know, that's really caught people's attention. On the one hand, people will be happy, especially in the area that this is happening, if they get rid of Daesh. But on the other hand, there is sort of this question of why the magnitude of such a bomb.
Right.
You know, why did it have to be something of this level?
Again, we're talking about a 22,000-pound bomb. A Pentagon spokesman told the Associated Press that this bomb contains 11 tons of explosives. And Business Insider reports that once this bomb drops, it basically destroys one or two city blocks. It kind of looked at what would happen if this bomb was dropped in Los Angeles or New York City. And I watched a lot of the cable shows last night. Very few questions about why a bomb of this size was dropped in the first place.
Exactly. And that's sort of the question that all of us journalists. So today, none of us were allowed onto the actual site. We were on a hilltop maybe about 5 kilometers away. And the actual site was hidden behind two other hills over this valley, so we couldn't really even see what the impact of it was. And there were still U.S. helicopters, you know, flying in the air. We heard a few explosions. You know, the reporters that were there before us since 9 o'clock in the morning said they heard several explosions. We heard maybe two or three, and there was smoke rising at certain points from different parts of the hills and the valley. So, you know, there is this sense that something is still going on. The fighting is still going on. And that was the thing is that, you know, there were reporters there that were waiting since 9 a.m. and, you know, until like 4 or 5 in the afternoon. They waited, and eventually, you know, the Afghan commandos kept saying, oh, we're trying to clear the area, we're trying to clear the area. We don't know when it'll be clear. So finally, you know, most of us, just all of us, headed back to Jalalabad because, you know, we can't stay there overnight. And, you know, hoping on the chance that tomorrow it'll be cleared at some point and we can go to the actual site and get a sense of what was happening. Because when I left Kabul, everyone was like, oh, go see and see if there's a giant hole in the ground, you know? Mm. And we didn't get a sense of that at all, what it actually looks like.
Ali, Afghan officials say the bomb killed 36 fighters. Do we know if civilians were killed? And what do you think of the statement from Afghan officials?
Even Afghan officials, like, who has gone to the scene? You know, there were some commandos that went. There were some special forces. There were U.S. forces that went. But there was, as far as I know, no other government, as in, like, a district governor or provincial governor or anyone else of that nature, or, for instance, the president or the chief executive, who went to see really what happened. And because the site is basically at this point cordoned off, we don't really know what happened, you know. And the thing is, we have to remember that in Afghanistan, as with many other countries in the world, there's always reports of, oh, you know, we killed 10 fighters, we killed 20 fighters, we killed 30 fighters, and there's really no way to verify that.
Right.
Especially, you know, I mean, right now, the entire Afghan press's attention is on Achin. But normally, you know, if they say, like, there was a drone strike or an airstrike and it killed 10 fighters or 10 Daesh or 10 Taliban or whatever you want to say, in Achin, most people just take it for granted and say that's what they said. And so, again, it is sort of one of those questions of, you know, how do you know that there are no civilians in the area? And the thing is that so we talked to Afghan commandos near the area who had went and inspected the site and who are part of this ongoing operation in the area, and they said that about a month ago they had basically dropped cards and, like, found ways to distribute cards that told people to leave, that said, you know, the operation is going to get more intense and to leave. But then one commando told me, he said that you know, at the same time, Daesh was threatening people, saying, if you leave, don't expect to come back to your land. So that definitely, you know, might have instilled some fear in some people who, you know, may have not left. But the fact is that at this point, we don't know who stayed there. We don't know who, you know. I even basically, like, the families living in the area where we were, which, like I said, about 5 kilometers from the actual site, when we tried talking to them, you know, they all just basically said, we don't know anything, we didn't see anything, we didn't hear anything. And obviously, you know, U.S. helicopters were flying overhead, Afghan commandos were on the ground, there were still explosions going off. So I think, you know, part of that has to do with the tension of the immediacy of the event.
Before we let you go, we're speaking with Ali Latifi, an Afghan journalist who's joining us from Jalalabad. According to the Washington Post, there are 8,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan and 7,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that sounds about right. But you have to remember that there was talk of the Trump administration wanting to send 1,500 more. And at the end of the day, you know, the question we have to ask is, to what end? You know, to what end are, because Nicholson, when he spoke, I can't remember if he spoke to this, when he addressed a branch of the U.S. government, I can't remember which one, he called it, you know, a stalemate. He said, the situation is in Afghanistan is a stalemate, and so we need more soldiers. And of course, the question is, you know, will more foreign soldiers actually make that impact? Or is it time to start figuring out how to, you know, put pressure on Pakistan, put pressure on Russia, put pressure on Iran, you know, to really force the Taliban to the negotiating table and to figure out what to do about Daesh? Because at this point, you know, the Afghan government is fighting two major groups. They're continuing to fight the Taliban and they're trying to fight off Daesh, which, you know, the numbers are ambiguous at this point, but still, you know, they are fighting off two groups at the same time.
And before we let you go, Ali, what would you like listeners to know about what life is like for ordinary Afghans? You have another story you wrote called Pushed Out of Pakistan into War-Torn Afghanistan, Refugees Are Told to Be Patient. And you write about how difficult life is for so many Afghan refugees.
I mean, yeah, the truth of the matter is, you know, oftentimes we hear the EU, especially, you know, Pakistan and Iran don't necessarily have to make this claim. They can just say, you know, they're a security threat or, you know, their time is done, we want them out. But especially from the EU, you know, we hear this claim that there are, quote-unquote, safe zones in Afghanistan, you know, including the major cities. And the thing is, we've seen time and time again, yes, of course life goes on and people try and build their lives no matter what. That's just part of human nature. But the thing is that there is this unexpected, I mean, did anyone think that at some point the U.S. would drop, you know, the largest non-nuclear weapon in the history of the world on, you know, a village in Afghanistan? No. And did people think that, you know, on Wednesday afternoon that, you know, the government workers would be targeted in an area that's also, you know, populated by civilians and by businesses and taxis and things like that? You know, did they think that a suicide bombing would go off then in Kabul, in the capital? No. And so I think that that's the reality. The reality is that people, yes, are trying to go on with their lives and they are trying to make it through, but at the same time, there's no way to guess what's coming next, you know, to understand. There's always this uncertainty. And when people say, you know, we don't know if we'll make it back alive, you know, in the evening when we leave in the morning, it's true. It's not a farce. It's really the truth. And despite people, you know, trying to make it through, this is a part of daily life in Afghanistan.
Well, Ali, thank you again for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
That is Ali Latifi. He is a journalist who's joining us from Jalalabad, Afghanistan, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Today it is our media roundtable, and we are also joined by Michael Stoll, executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, and Neela Banerjee is an award-winning reporter for Inside Climate News. And before we switch gears and talk about your reporting on climate change, Neela, I just wanted to ask you, what really strikes you about the reporting on this bombing? It seems like the last couple of shows we've changed our Fridays because something major happened on Thursday night.
Right, there's been some kind of bombing. I know, I think that's every day in Washington with, you know, the reporting that I see here. I mean, I do investigative stuff, so I'm not reporting every day, but I think that Ali asked the right questions. When I heard about the bombing, I was like, why this weapon? Why here? I mean, it sort of came out of the blue, and I think that is what is so unnerving to Americans, to journalists, to our allies overseas, and or even to people, to governments with whom we have a more complicated relationship, such as the Chinese, that there's a level of unpredictability and opacity to this administration. And so I think, and I also think Ali's asking very much the right questions, and I haven't seen this really addressed in the media here either about, are these body counts trustworthy? So these are questions that most mainstream media, especially TV, don't ask. And, you have ombudsmen like Margaret Sullivan of The Washington Post, who is terrific and writes about this sort of rally around the flag impulse in the media and this, sense that somehow by dropping a bomb, Trump looks more presidential. But that's sort of after the fact, that, that's only what media wonks read. So I think the things that Ali pointed out are the same things that made me wonder too, and we haven't gotten satisfactory answers really. Why this weapon, and what's really going on the ground?
Right, and if you have access to the Pentagon, why not push back when they, put out various information about, for example, how many people were killed, or why did you use this kind of bomb? How often do these bombings happen? When they're not 22,000 pounds, we don't really hear about it much.
Right. Well, so I think from what I've read a little bit of is, and look, I haven't read everything that's out there on this. I'm sort of an interested lay reader like the average person, and from what I've read, they thought there was a series of bunkers and this was a way to destroy these caves and so on. And apparently they had been used under the Obama administration before, but there's sort of a weird fanfare about this, right? Like, oh my gosh, look at Trump, dropping this bomb. And so I think a lot of print media, I know colleagues who cover the Pentagon and they do push back, but most Americans consume their news through television media and they don't push back as hard. And what you have to understand about Washington is that access is the coin of the realm, regardless of what you cover, whether it's the White House or Congress or the Pentagon. So it's the unusual reporter who really pushes back hard. I actually think the Pentagon people push back harder than a lot of others. So, a lot of folks, especially in TV, don't push back that hard.
Michael, what struck you about the reporting?
I think the major question that needs to be asked on the domestic side is how the kind of shock and awe military approach under the Trump administration is a reflection of the need to perhaps justify military spending that he's proposing in his new budget. He's proposing a 10% increase in the military budget, slashing domestic programs and environmental protection. If you use a large and impressive bomb that has not been used before in the battlefield, does that create a justification retroactively to get more military spending through? And, there have been lots of stories about connections between military contractors and Trump himself and his own investments. So I think a lot more investigative and spot news reporting has to be done about the domestic justification for war. And this is the third military intervention during the opening days of the Trump administration. First it was Yemen, then it was Syria, and now Afghanistan. What's next, and how much of this is going to be used for domestic consumption?
And according to the AP, each of these weapons is reported to cost about $15 million. And we will definitely cover that angle because that's really important. Neela, I know you have to go in about 10 minutes. So let's dive in and talk about what's happening between the United States and Russia. And you've been extensively covering this. In February, you had a really interesting piece, Russia and the U.S. Could Be Partners in Climate Change in Action. And let's talk about Rex Tillerson's visit to Russia. He's kind of reinventing himself as a tough-talking diplomat and the voice of U.S. foreign policy around the world. Inside Climate News has done extensive reporting about Exxon when Rex Tillerson was the CEO there. You've all reported that the company signed a $500 billion deal for gas and oil exploration in the Russian Arctic in 2011, and Rex Tillerson was awarded a state medal by Vladimir Putin in 2013. His appointment was welcomed by Russia, and journalist Steve Cole in his book pointed out that his ties with Russia played a significant role in him getting the top position at Exxon. What do you think about Rex Tillerson's rhetoric toward Russia right now?
Well, I think it's too early to tell what this, you know, how long this rhetoric will last, what kind of impact it'll have, and you know, why it's articulated at this point. I mean, is Trump really upset about Russia's partnering with Syria or support of Syria as Syria uses chemical weapons? Did he have this emotional reaction that you know, that's the narrative that the media have put forth about why he made the decision to bomb the Syrian airbase? Or is it frustration that on Trump's part that people continue to say that he is somehow continue to imply that there might be some kind of collusion between the Trump team and the Russians? You know, is he trying to put distance between himself and Putin? I think it's still too early to tell. What we can talk about that is clearer, where there is, you know, some kind of, I don't know if it's cooperation, but certainly an aligning of interests, is on the climate change front, right? And basically, you know, Trump has been scaling back all of the initiatives that the Obama administration, or trying to scale back all the initiatives that the Obama administration put forth to reduce carbon emissions from the United States. And the interesting thing is that Putin, so Trump signed an executive order in late March where he talked about basically increasing fossil fuel output and scaling back on climate. Well, Putin a few days later was speaking at this forum on the Arctic in Arkhangelsk in Russia, and during the Paris climate talks in 2015, he actually pivoted and was supporting climate science after years of denial. Well, now he's back to denial after this early April talk. So maybe, I'm not saying that what Trump did with the executive order somehow prompted Putin to say this, but I think it sort of gives him the latitude. You know, he's not an outlier, right? He is. You know, the president of the United States can be a climate denier, so can the president of Russia.
And we just got an email from a listener, Henry, who sent over a Think Progress report about Putin praising U.S. EPA head Scott Pruitt during
the
TV interview.
Right. He looks at Pruitt as an authority on climate science and climate change, even though Pruitt is not a scientist. He's a lawyer, and, you know, there was a Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles that the New York Times did a few years ago that basically showed that Pruitt worked hand in glove with the fossil fuel industry to petition, to sue the EPA, to petition them not to take action on climate when he was attorney general in Oklahoma.
And he said that he looks forward to the Arctic melting because it's an economic opportunity.
Right. So the way the Russians, until 2015, talked about climate change was, questioning the science or talking about the fact that climate change could be good for Russia, that it could open up more of Russia for either oil and gas development or increase the growing season and so on. What they don't talk about, however, are things like sea level rise and wildfires, right? And you know, the thing about economic development, what Putin is talking about, is the fact that, you know, you have to understand that Russia is a petrostate, right? Russia's, you know, like, I think like 45% of its budget is tied to oil and gas exports, and 45% of its greenhouse gases are tied to oil and gas exports, oil and gas production, and so, you know, they so their greenhouse gases come from oil and gas, but so do their budget revenues, and it supports the economy. So to them, or to Putin rather, you know, opening up the Arctic, greater melting in the Arctic means greater shipping opportunities and easier access to oil and gas. Now the problem is, like, the more you develop that oil and gas, the more you accelerate climate change. So it's about this sort of short term petrostate economic development as opposed to bringing about shifts in the economy.
And the Washington Post today is reporting that Trump's EPA chief Scott Pruitt is calling for an exit to the Paris Climate Agreement.
Yes, he did. He talked about that. He we wrote about that too, and it was in an interview that he did on Fox and Friends. I think it was yesterday, and I think they're still mulling what to do. Part of it is that if they were to, there's sort of advantages and disadvantages as far as like exiting the agreement or exiting the UNFCCC, which is, the climate body of the UN, and, the United States could just do nothing, right? They could be a signatory to the agreement, but they could just do nothing. I mean, it's interesting because that's the argument that Pruitt uses about other countries. Well, how can you enforce this with other countries? And, you can't. Well, clearly the United States can stay part of this and stay part of the agreement and not do its share, and nobody can enforce it. Nobody can say anything.
And Nila, I know you have to go in just a couple of minutes, but you specifically focus on climate change, and so much is happening. There was another report recently about how Scott Pruitt might need Secret Service detail. I mean, how are you deciding where to focus? Because you all do in-depth investigations, which take time and resources, yet things are moving so quickly day by day. In fact, we're just learning that Rex Tillerson rewrote its climate change page. And within a week of the inauguration, the site's language and format received a substantial overhaul. So how are you deciding where to focus?
Right. So there's at Inside Climate, there's a small team of us who do investigations, and I'm one of that team. But I have colleagues who are based in Washington and who are covering a lot of the action or inaction on climate. And I think the way it's going, I mean, look, we're small. We're a dozen people. We don't have the resources of the Washington Post or the Times or anybody else. But the way we do this and the way I see it is that all of us are contributing pieces of the picture, right? Like, and I mean, even big entities such as the Times and the Post can't do everything because there's so much going on climate and the broader environment and so on. And so everybody's contributing different, different bits of information, and it comes together to form a bigger picture. And periodically, we, other media, take a step back and tell you what's going on. And what's going on is that they're working very actively to push fossil fuels way forward and scale back massively on climate action and really do nothing on renewables. So the question is whether states and industry can pick up the slack and whether litigation can force the Trump administration to behave differently. And, we're just a few months in, so there's a long haul ahead of us.
What about you, Michael? How do you all decide where to focus at SF Public Press?
We're focused locally, and we're seeing a really interesting back and forth between the priorities of California and local governments and the kind of uncertainty but general momentum that is anti-environmental from the Trump administration. And so much of what's happening in the state is really about trying to anticipate the moves of the federal government and be proactive in shoring up the most important environmental programs. At the same time, I think there are many cracks in our local and state regulations.
And Nila, speaking of what you focus on, what are you working on right now?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
I'm an investigative reporter. I can't tell you. But what I can say is that I'm very proud of the work that that we are doing to look at this administration and to put things in perspective. I mean, there are a lot of things that we cover that that people don't. I mean, and and one thing about climate is that there was a study that just came out that we wrote about yesterday that shows that we probably need to scale back greenhouse gas emissions much more rapidly than even the signatories and the scientists behind the Paris Agreement determined. And so by like say 2040 rather than after 2050. So these are the kinds of things that help fill out the picture. And you know, we can't do it all, but together, we, the other media, everybody can complete the picture for people who want to know about this.
Well, I just read your 4Xon hybrid car technology was another road not taken, and that kind of blew me away. We'd love to have you on another time to talk about that. So thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for your reporting, Neela.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Neela Banerjee is an award-winning reporter for Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization that focuses on climate change. Michael Stoll is executive director and editor of San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit that publishes a quarterly newspaper. And Michael, you all have a new investigation looking at climate change, sea level rise, and waterfront developments in San Francisco. It's out now in bookstores, and it'll be online on Monday. Talk about, I mean, you've consistently covered sea level rise, but tell us how you decided to focus on these three issues.
The three issues of...
Why you decided to continue focusing on sea level rise, and what's the new information that you found?
Well, we published our first cover story on sea level rise in the summer of 2015, and we documented by just looking around the bay and looking at press reports and environmental impact reports, 27 mega projects that were occurring in an area that is of concern to local planners, that's 8 feet above the mean high tide. And that is kind of the worst case scenario for a bad day in the year 2100. So if you were to take a precautionary approach to planning for sea level rise, anticipating the damage that flooding might cause in the lifetime of toddlers alive today, you would start to look at that zone, and that's hundreds of acres of new development, and that's the Embarcadero Piers, Mission Bay, Pier 70, Hunter's Point, Candlestick Point, the new fancy headquarters of Google and Facebook, Alameda Air Base, Treasure Island, and the list goes on. Since then, the development in this zone seems to have accelerated. We found 8 new projects. That's a total of 35 that we're tracking on our website and in the centerfold of the new edition. And then many more smaller projects, as many as 50 in San Francisco, including in south of Market, Mission Bay. And we even noticed after the last week that there's indications that the Transbay Terminal, which is still under construction, the waves could hypothetically lap up against the foundation of that structure.
Wow.
By the year 2100 in a really worst case scenario. And I think the thing is, we're seeing that if the federal government kind of pushes to ramp up carbon emissions, the worst case scenario could take place.
We'll talk about the development in just a couple of minutes and how you're getting this information. But you also report that if the West Antarctic ice sheet melts, it would push water along North America in the San Francisco Bay far higher than the global average. This is not something we hear about when we talk about what's happening in the Antarctic.
In general, the trend in every subsequent scientific report is to push the estimates higher. And scientists are generally conservative. They don't want to overstate the case. So they only use the information they have really, really locked down. In 2015, we used the estimate of 8 feet, which includes about 5.5 feet of permanent inundation in the kind of high range model, plus about 3.5 feet of potential storm surge in a bad storm. Since then, last year, there was a report that said that it could be as high as 10 feet. And that is actually, as of 2 days ago, the governor, Governor Brown, issued a report, a guideline for local governments on sea level rise, and that shift has taken place. West coast of the United States is expected to experience more sea level rise than the global average, in part because of the gravitational shifts in the structure of the ocean in the Antarctic. These are all part of very complex climate models, but we have to be planning for that.
You wrote another investigation about sea level rise in the Bay and how it will affect development and a lot of these tech companies. What kind of response did you get from that?
Well, we're still following up some indications that our report had influence in the structure of committees and staff in the mayor's office and in City Hall. And we're really actually encouraged by that. And people at independent think tanks and in state agencies have told us that they appreciated the clarity of, you know, expressing the urgency of action, in particular because, you know, a lot of the research has been focused, you know, a lot of the research on the costs of sea level rise in the Bay has focused on existing infrastructure. And I think what we focused on was how developers are currently in the process really of making things worse by rushing to develop right along the waterfront, despite all of the new science that's coming out, and really they have new tools since 2015, new legal tools to push back against regulation, and that's the cover story in this issue.
Like what legal tools?
So after our report came out in the fall of 2015, the California Supreme Court ruled in favor of the California Building Industry Association in its argument that that the CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which many local governments had used to regulate for sea level rise, could not be used in the context of climate change, which is kind of counterintuitive. You would think the primary state law guiding development, across the state, would apply to sea level to climate change in general. But the court said that they could only regulate, local governments could only regulate for the effect of the environment on the project, not the effect of the project on the project on the environment, not the effect of the environment on the project. So if you build a project in 2017 and in 2057 the environment changes and people's lives and property are threatened, that's not the responsibility of the developer now. Hmm. And so what we found in the last year and a quarter, ever since that ruling came out, is that more and more lawyers for developers have used this language and inserted it into environmental impact reports in response to pressure from local governments to change their plans to raise the level of the land to be more resilient to sea level rise, to waterproof their basements, to create more buffer zones, to create, you know, all sorts of potential solutions. The developers have said, no, we don't have to do that. We'll work with you to do some of this stuff, but you can't force us to make these changes to make our property more resilient to sea level rise. And they've used the language in lawsuits. They've used it in responses to people complaining about or, you know, having questions about the effect of sea level rise in their communities, all ringing the Bay. And this is a story that hasn't really come out, largely because it's very hard to navigate environmental impact reports from cities and counties. So what we did was we created a custom scraper of websites around the Bay and downloaded a couple of thousand pages of environmental impact reports and searched for the language from these court cases and found a consistent pattern that the lawyers had really discovered and out.
Are city officials pushing back against this?
Some are, but so far there really are not very many strong legal tools that they can use. Planners can cajole and suggest and threaten, but statewide there have been no efforts so far to address this change that the California Supreme Court issued in 2015, really undercutting the intent, I feel, of the California Environmental Quality Act.
It seems like this should be getting a lot more attention because we're talking about the future of the city and the Bay, really. Yesterday, I noticed on the front page, or it was Wednesday, I think, the front page of the Chronicle, there was a story called Sea Level Rise in California Could Be Catastrophic. Are local reporters looking at these angles?
I say, you know, in response to press releases and press conferences, to the extent that state and local regulators, issue some new finding, that information trickles out. And there was a report from the governor's office 2 days ago indicating that, that local governments should anticipate really severe flooding, and they should start taking precautions now. In San Francisco, I think in a lot of local governments there is this real tension between the need for tax revenue and for legacy projects for local officials, and at the same time that Mayor Ed Lee in San Francisco has impaneled a interagency organization to look into and write reports about the threat of sea level rise, he's also very vocally advocating waterfront projects, including the Warriors Arena, which will be built, which is actually now has broken ground in Mission Bay, which is just a stone's throw away from the bay and is in the flood zone that we've identified. As well as the Mission Rock development owned by the San Francisco Giants.
When we do shows about the changing Bay Area and San Francisco, a lot of listeners say you need to spend more time focusing on the developers. Most people cannot name a developer. What has that been like to try to get information specifically from the developers? Do they call you back? Do they answer questions?
A few have called us back. I think that one of the things that we found by looking specifically at the Warriors Arena and Mission Rock, looking at these two sports franchises, they like to work directly, through the political system, and they have they've pushed their projects through the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission.
Right, they've struck a lot of deals.
They struck a lot of deals, and they're talking, they're talking directly to government officials. They are really not engaging the public in a way that acknowledges the extent of the problem. I think a case in point is one of the other stories that we wrote is that there was a report produced by Spur and a couple of architectural and consultants for the city that it took 2 years for the city to publish. And the last draft of the report was ready in June 2015, and that was just a couple of months before. June 2016. That was far after the Warriors Arena was approved by the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors. It's a $1 billion complex, and the voters voted to approve height limits to enable Mission Rock development, which is a $1.6 billion development, I believe, also in Mission Bay. And one of the planning commissioners said if he had known about this report that really called for massive reconstruction of Mission Bay in order to protect it from sea level rise in the future, that if he had known about it, the Planning Commission might have taken a second look.
Wow.
And so there's really this disconnect between the environmental interest of local and state officials and the economic interest.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Again, this is a massive investigation looking at climate change, sea level rise, and waterfront developments. And the special report is now in bookstores. It'll be online on Monday. And you sent us an advance copy, and there's a photo on the front page that shows areas in the city that are in danger of being flooded by the sea level rise. And this is a report from San Francisco Public Press. What is the major takeaway, would you say, for people who live in the Bay Area and are concerned about what's happening here? What's the major takeaway from this report?
We need to have consistent rules and regulations, both for the sake of the communities that are planning for growth in the long term, and planning also for the housing boom that is happening now. We're trying to build more housing as quickly as possible. We're also trying to develop the economy as the technology industry expands and creates wealth for the community. But I think mostly we're taking some shortcuts in terms of environmental protections, and that will come back to haunt us and our children and our grandchildren. And there are trade-offs, and they will be costly. And we're actually already starting to pay for it. Measure AA last summer that we approved, it was a regional measure, approved a $500 million tax over 20 years in order to pay for wetlands restoration. So the costs are starting to mount up already, even as climate change really starts to, the effects of climate change really start to accelerate. And we need to be prepared for it. We need to be planning now, not 50 years from now, not 10 or 5 years, but now.
And would you say, based on the people that you interviewed, the city is really failing to take this seriously at this point?
There are many really smart, really motivated and concerned people in all across city government, in think tanks, in academe, who are doing far-reaching research, and they have ideas about how to best balance growth and environmental protection. And the mayor's committee is expected to release an action plan, an implementation plan by 2018. We'll see if that has any real teeth to it and regulation of private property. But that's something that's going to be increasingly on the agenda.
And you can find this report about climate change, sea level rise, and waterfront developments in San Francisco from San Francisco Public Press in bookstores over the weekend, and then it'll be online on Monday. San Francisco Public Press is a local nonprofit news organization that publishes a quarterly newspaper, and Michael Stoll is its executive director and editor. Michael, thanks so much for your reporting. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
And also, speaking about changes in the Bay Area, on Monday, we're going to have a conversation about ride-hailing companies and how they're impacting transportation and life in the Bay Area. In 2016, San Francisco had the third worst traffic congestion in the country. According to the Examiner, 45,000 Uber and Lyft drivers are now working in the city. So we're going to talk about solutions to increased congestion. And we also want to hear from you. What changes are you seeing? We're all feeling these changes. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Sadie Gribben is our intern. Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you for listening.